What's your name?
Fox.
Do you remember that experiment, Fox, or that, that experience of playing with the sticks
and
the
fire? It's ongoing.
Can you maybe, you think you can talk about what it was about the stick that interested you?
Well, I mean, you can just use it for so many different, like, uses, and I don't know.
What kind of things would you use it for?
Like I have rope, and I could, like, tie them together to make, like, things, weapons.
Weapons.
Build things with them.
Very cool. Did it ever occur to you, or did you ever have the thought that maybe the stick was alive, that it wasn't just a stick? Did that thought ever occur to you?
Not really.
Fair enough. For those of you who have children or who have worked closely with children, have you ever observed children sort of speaking of things that they encounter in the world, like rocks and sticks and clouds, and speaking of them as if they had life, as if they were thinking, living things?
Giving them names.
Right. Mm-hmm. Does anybody have any examples that they'd like to share of that? Sure.
When I was a kid, I thought that things had feelings, so I would try to sit carefully in my chair so as not to hurt feelings.
Mm-hmm. That's a perfect example. Any others? Yeah, Michelle.
In an office one time, I remember feeling bad about breaking my pen, and my a coworker saying, "Oh, and it never got to be fully self-actualized. It was what it was meant to be."
How many of us have named, especially our older cars, and because they have such personalities, and like so uniquely personable amongst even the same model from the same factory. Like once they've been on the road a few hundred miles or whatever, you know.
I find myself, well, I do have a name for my truck, but if I'm running very low on gas and I know I have about 15 miles and I'm like, oh, I'll start talking very nicely to my, they're like, oh, we can do this, we got this. I just really encourage it. Come on, Clyde, let's do it.
With my small compact, I do it on really steep hills, too. But you got this.
The little engine that thought it is, are you talking to the car or yourself?
A little bit of both, but yeah.
But I think of being a child and, you know, toys and stuff, and my mother wouldn't give us toy guns, and we had all the toy guns we wanted.
The other day, my son bit a pork chop into the shape of a gun. Which we wouldn't let him have guns either.
That's awesome.
He actually liked swords better anyway because they had more panache, you know.
Has anybody either seen the Netflix show or read Marie Kondo's book about tidying up?
Mm-hmm.
And you thank the thing for what it's brought into your life, and you help it to go on to have a good life by getting it unstuck from your closet. Right? And she's totally genuine about it.
Mm-hmm. Well, I read this book one time. It's called How to Want What You Have. Because we have such an innate desire to want more and more, even if we have enough. And one of the exercises was to go through and touch everything you already own.
Right.
And boy, I found stuff I had forgotten about for 20 years. It's like, oh my gosh. We just keep accumulating without really appreciating the items.
Helps if you move often.
Yes.
So this experience of attributing to things that we normally consider to be inanimate or lifeless objects is what's called animism. And there's been a great deal of study into this way of thinking, and it's particularly been of interest to developmental psychologists, child psychologists in the 20th century, because it's been observed to be a pretty much universal phenomenon for children of a certain age. And there's one a Swiss psychologist in particular, Jean Piaget, who wrote a lot about this. And his way of thinking about child development is that children progress through certain stages in an invariable order. There's some variation in age, but you can generally chart the mental development of children.
Here comes a bike. Oh, no, never mind.
We're not on the trail.
Are you coming down?
We're not on the trail anyway.
Oh, okay. Sorry.
But so for his theory, so from about the age 0 to 2 years old, children's development is largely sensory motor. That what they're doing is they are fine-tuning their motor functions and sort of synchronizing them with the world. So you'll notice that if you put your finger in a baby's hand, they'll grasp it, and that's because they're just, you know, sensing how their bodies interact with the world, and that's kind of what life is for a child for the first 2 years. And then from the age of 2 to 7, roughly, is the pre-operational period, and this is where children begin to develop thought, as he calls them. Thought for him essentially means language, the ability to manipulate words. But at this point in their life, it's still sort of an illogical, unorganized way of using language. And then once they get beyond that age of roughly 7, once they get to 8, they start to structure things more naturally. And so, as I said, Piaget thought that this was an invariable sequence that all children go through, no matter where they are in the world and what period of time that they that it's just a natural part of growing up. Not everybody agreed with Piaget. The observation of animism is certainly a universal phenomenon, but the implications of what that means for child development is certainly controversial. And there was another developmental psychologist, a Soviet psychologist, who worked in roughly the same period. And he also observed animism, but his view was not that this is something that we naturally grow out of. For him, this is something that has to be taught out of children. That essentially, this is a natural, instinctive way to view the world. That all human thought begins with instinct and emotion. And that animistic thinking is a natural, instinctive, emotional way of viewing the world. And that sort of broader, what he called scientific concepts, classifying things, grouping them into certain categories, such as living and non-living, conscious and non-conscious, is something that needs to be imposed upon them from the outside. And so, for example, children will develop spontaneous concepts through their first-person interaction with the world. And so their grandmother, the concept of the word grandmother to them, will initially mean their grandmother, the grandmother that plays games with them or reads them stories. But then they have to go to school, or they have to be taught through their community that grandmother can have other meanings, and it can refer to this generic concept that has to do with the relationship of one person to other people within a family tree. Similarly, a tree might be, for a child, is a place that they go to find shade, or where they can pluck an apple and eat it. But they have to be taught other concepts about what a tree means in the context of the world beyond their firsthand experience. And this could mean something like trees have sacred, inherent spirit that is worthy of respect on its own, or it can be something like trees and animals are resources here for our manipulation, and that these different ways of viewing the world are something that has to be imposed upon us, but they're not necessarily natural and inevitable ways of viewing the world. And I think that will segue maybe into some philosophical concepts that Henry will bring up.
Sure.
Really quick,
what was
the Russian guy's name?
Vygotsky.
Thank you.
So I think Vygotsky's insight that animism, or the lack thereof, as children age, and that it needs to be taught, is really useful to to keep in mind, because there are tons of cultures, non-Western cultures, that encourage that development. And we tend to, people who have just a very, you know, if you learn just in general about animism in other cultures, it might at first appear to be just another religion or just another, like, spiritual orientation, just another set of beliefs about reality. But on this analysis, it's more like a set of a way of viewing reality that comes from an innate sense, an innate perception of that reality, mm-hmm. that's fostered rather than squashed. So that an animistic set of beliefs is really a sort of emergent kind of spirituality or kind of disposition towards things. There's an ecophenomenologist, David Abram, who writes in favor of animism, and he argues for it as a disposition towards the world in a few different ways. But in relation to the sort of child development track, he writes about how young children tend to, and this is more anecdotal, but he writes about how young children tend to see themselves in everything, see everything as the same as them, as like, oh, like, this is Fred, he likes baseball like me, even though he's a chair, and so on. And that and what Abram sort of argues is that as children grow older, you know, in our society, that's cut off, that becomes like, no, Fred is a chair, he's not a friend of yours who likes baseball. But there's another way you can go with this, where the child, through deeper understanding, through growing older and developing a more complex perception of the world, learns the differences between themselves and, for instance, a tree, without assuming that the tree is exactly like them, but doesn't lose the sense that the tree is also itself something else, that there is some remarkably different way of being that the tree embodies. And so there's nothing... Martin Buber is a philosopher of encounter, and he has a lot of like interesting things to say about this. But he says, when you're taking a tree, like, he writes about seeing things as subjects rather than as objects, and he says that when you're taking a tree as a subject and not objectifying it, there's nothing you need to forget in order to see it as a subject. There's no fact about the tree you need to ignore. There's nothing you need to be like, oh, that's not just a tree of this species that works in this way. And so therefore it can't be a subject, and in order to think of it as an animate being, I need to forget all these facts about it. He says that it's the tree itself that can contain all of these things, that any way of thinking of the tree that cuts you off from your direct encounter with it is going to contain it and objectify it, but that you can encounter it with all of those things still intact in a deeply animistic way. That doesn't contradict a sort of logical way of viewing the world. And Abram writes about how in our culture we have this sort of oversimplified view of animism as a result of a sort of history of philosophical thought of separating the mind from matter, or of separating spirit from matter. And he talks about how a lot of Christian missionaries would go into indigenous villages and see these animistic practices and assume that these people believed there were spirits inside the trees, that there were spirits inside the rocks and inside the rivers. But Abram argues that it is in fact the rivers and the trees themselves, in the way that they present themselves to us in our experience, that appears animistic and willful and agential, and that part of our perception is not squashed in those cultures. And so this is, in philosophy, there's a difference between description and prescription, where description is what something is like and what it is. And so he's describing this animism as what it is like to attend to our senses, that things appear more vibrant and alive and animate the more we attend to our physical embodied being in the world. But he's also prescriptive about it, which means he's arguing that we should foster it. And his basis for that is sort of a pragmatic argument, in a way, that having an animistic connection towards the things around us helps us to foster a deeper sort of personal relationship to it, which will encourage ethical action towards us. And he argues for animistic belief, an animistic belief system on this basis. And he writes, let me just pull up, I took a picture of this quote, which is a good quote. Oh no, it's in another folder. Got it. All right. He writes that, ecologically considered, it is not primarily our verbal statements that are true or false, but rather the kind of relations that we sustain with the rest of nature. A human community that lives in a mutually beneficial relation with the surrounding earth is a community, we might say, that lives in truth. The ways of speaking common to that community, the claims and beliefs that enable such reciprocity to perpetuate itself, in this case animism, are, in this important sense, true. They are in accord with a right relation between these people and their world. Statements and beliefs, meanwhile, that foster violence toward the land, ways of speaking that enable the impairment or ruination of the surrounding field of beings, can be described as false ways of speaking, ways that encourage an unsustainable relation with the encompassing earth. A civilization that relentlessly destroys the living land it inhabits is not well acquainted with truth, regardless of how many supposed facts it has amassed regarding the calculable properties of its world. So, I'll end with that. I know that was pretty dense, so if anyone has any questions to clarify in regards to that.
With this process.
I'd push back a little bit on the idea that those beliefs have to be taught, because if they have to be taught, who is the original teacher? You got to sort of bootstrap it.
Which beliefs have to be
taught out, I think. The animism is taught out of us. Is that...
Yeah. Well, the idea that you have to learn that, say, the concept of grandmother isn't just your grandmother. Somebody has to teach you that. I think that can be observed, because we're really good at pattern matching. And we can see that, okay, you talk to your grandmother and say grandmother, and I talk to my grandmother. Sooner or later, we're gonna make that connection. So I don't think that all of those structures are necessarily forced on us from the outside. I think that we can actually create those connections ourselves.
I think I would think what Vygotsky and others would say is that it's that they are, those thoughts are constructed socially. That essentially that it requires the intercourse through language that those sort of structures are felt. The concept of family trees and grandmothers as a relationship within the family tree is something that we develop communally. But an individual, you know, just growing up in the world on their own, obviously wouldn't come through that. But this is a particular structure that we have created to describe our family trees, and that particular structure is transmitted through education from one generation to the next. But its initial development is through social interaction.
Yeah, so think there maybe about some of these societies that have different kinship relations that are really important, just to keep this example. Societies where the people who raise children are the mother and the brothers of the mother. Yeah. And there are nice, simple, like one-word labels for those. But to describe the man who helped to conceive you is a very complicated idea. Mm-hmm. And children don't get that idea until much later in life. And it's weird, and it's a phrase, and it's whatever. Mm-hmm. So whatever structures our society has, we pick them up very quickly, you know, by pattern matching, by recognizing them as children. And we learn them so young that we just take them as adults. Oh, that's just how the world is. That's just what the categories are that divide the world up. But when we look around, by comparing the different sorts of categories, the different sorts of modes of encountering the world in these different places, these different communities, that can give us the perspective of, boy, we had to kind of learn this too. Or at least some of us had to do some learning in some of these communities, and odds are we were all doing it. That may pick up on Vygotsky's point in a certain way.
I remember, I have a peculiarity. I remember my teeth coming in. I remember learning how to walk. I remember my diapers being changed. It comes with being an egomaniac. I remember learning like how to use knives and forks and stuff. And I remember that the motivation was shame and competition and conformity, because I had older siblings that all did this, and the fact that I was eating with my fingers meant that I was inferior to them, and I was ridiculed, you know, I was treated, you know, and they were bigger, so they were obviously superior in some way, and I wanted to be as big as them and all of that, and a lot of the motivations of things that I was learning how to make my hands work and do things was not just exploration, it was imitation, and it was socially motivated, that it was motivated by wanting to not be odd or outcast.
So what do you think is the motivation to start thinking of a tree as a resource for paper instead of thinking of it as a living being with as much rights as you? Like, is it our culturalization that does it? Because you said some cultures don't mm-hmm. lose that. So what's the motivation in our culture to switch our mindset off?
Well, you get made fun of, and if you keep doing it long enough, you get put in an institution. That's a pretty powerful motive.
That's the personal motivation. That's why it perpetuates. But I guess, or you may be asking, what's the origin?
Society.
Like, how did that start off to be the case?
Well, I think why is like, it so prevalent now to not consider a tree an organism with equal rights as other living organisms?
It doesn't just apply to trees. I mean,
right.
Every society goes to war. And when they go to war, they objectify their opponents.
Yes, mm-hmm.
And so
absolutely.
It's a form of rationalization. Mm-hmm. It's the ability to say, I am superior, therefore it's
yes.
okay to kill this person,
absolutely.
Or it's okay to harvest this tree.
Right.
And so it's a form of rationalization, I think, more than something peculiar to our society.
Also, I would say there's a historical reason why our culture has this particular orientation that has to do with, has a lot to do with philosophical dualism, which is just sort of this sense that there is a separate spiritual world, and then that separate spiritual world became the separate mental world when it became secular. But that notion, which I think came about due to monotheistic religions that were based
right.
in a desert environment where there was this stark, I mean, I think it's all environmental at root, but
sure.
But that separation was in a stark desert environment where, you know, where you had this like really strong, like this why, I just think there's a real phenomenological, I guess, basis for why it developed this distinction, but that distinction kind of went through our society through the generations and became these notions and presuppositions we have. Where we believe we can sort of separate ourselves out of the material, that we believe that our minds are immaterial, mm-hmm. that we are can step outside of the world and look upon it as if we're gods, and that gives us the sense of privilege, I think, to be able to dismiss the experience and life of the many things around us. And there was one other thing I wanted to bring up before we moved on, which is just in reference to what it does for the world, and in reference to that question of animism, because Abram is saying that if it's good for the world, we should do it, essentially. There are some ways that are immediately evident that you know, you care more for things you have a personal connection with. But there's also, like, imagine a world where you're morally accountable to all of the things around you.
Wow.
And what effect that would have on your behavior. Imagine if you believed that when you're walking through the forest, the trees are all watching you
mm-hmm.
and evaluating your actions.
Mm-hmm.
And if you harm them, they feel it and they
mm-hmm.
are upset. And they and first of all, there would be reasons why you wouldn't want to anger those spirits that you
mm-hmm.
call spirits
mm-hmm.
or beings or the world around you because of the effect it might have. Because with believing that they're more than just dead things that are interacting with other things, you would also believe there are things about them you don't understand or couldn't comprehend. So you would believe there might be forces that would affect, that you wouldn't be able to know, like there, you know, a spirit or a home of these things that would then impact your own life, that you would be judged in that way. And I mean, there's a similar thing with religion and being motivated to moral action by the notion that God is watching you. But consider the difference between a distant God watching you and judging your actions versus the things around you watching you and judging your actions. Whereas God could say, cut down this forest for me and build me a cathedral, and where you could affect the things around you in a negative way due to some belief in what some transcendent and distant God wants of you, that would be almost contradictory. That would be almost impossible in an animistic world of accountability, because the things around you would be what are holding you
yeah.
accountable. So how could you exploit them for the sake of some higher good if they're what exactly is holding you accountable? Anyway, I wanted to point that out because I think it gives some clarity to why animism might be a morally pragmatic way of looking at things.
I want to just throw it to us. I agree that the mind-body dualism probably has
old roots that I think do help explain this phenomenon of why we're willing to distinguish ourselves. I would also say that I think it's probably that belief is very convenient for a modern capitalist society that
yes.
is dedicated to wealth production. And it's very convenient to think of trees as resources for wealth production, and animals too is another one that I think about a lot. Like our the fact that we can think of creatures that are so obviously sentient and capable of suffering in so many ways, and we just put blinders on and we convince ourselves that these are unthinking, unfeeling products. So I would say that probably our political and economic structures help perpetuate this one particular way of viewing the world.
So I was in an ethics class, Thomas Beimaster, if anybody knows him, and I started reassessing how I view things, and as a result, somebody at an Earth Day conference, they gave me a ponderosa pie seedling, and I took it home, and I didn't really want a tree in my yard, and before that class I would have just put it in the compost bin and composted it, and after the class I was like, well, that's like somebody handing you a puppy that you don't want and you're just going to set it outside to die, because like, it gave me a whole new perspective of that tree is a living thing and it has a right to survive. Like, it has a right to be alive and and live its life. And that switch in mindset took such a long time for me to adopt. I wonder how in our society we could change that mindset so that people have more respect for all living things.
I don't know if any of you guys have heard of the book The Golden Spruce, but it's a really good story, but it touches a lot on the idea of, it focuses on like one specific tree that it had like a genetic abnormality, but somehow it was thriving, but it like was this golden color. And so it showed like the different perspectives of like, there's an indigenous community that really valued it for the spirit that it had. Scientists valued it for what it could teach us about biology. But it was about a man who was, because of the culture that he was raised in, he was a logger as well. And he didn't understand why this tree was more valuable than any of the other trees that they were logging, cutting down. And so it's kind of about the ethics of like the spirit of, I guess, of trees, of like living things that aren't humans, and how do we like see those based on like where we're from and our life experiences. Does that sound interesting? Really.
The Golden Spruce? Is that
that's cool.
Spruce.
Right.
Do you know who wrote it? It's okay if you don't.
I do not.
Okay. Well, it's a memorable title. Thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah. Cool.